Welcome to the Curiosity Collective, the podcast that takes you on a journey through the most intriguing scientific discoveries. I'm Tom, and joining me as always is my co-host, Jen.
Hey there, listeners. Today, we're delving into a fascinating paper that challenges the way we think about human learning and flexibility. The title of the study is Beyond Independent Latent Classes, Testing the Limits of Human Flexibility.
This research really pushes the boundaries of what we know about how humans organize and generalize their knowledge. The authors argue that the current theoretical framework of latent classes doesn't fully capture the complexity of human generalization abilities.
That's right, Tom. Traditionally, the latent class framework has proposed that humans organize their knowledge into a collection of independent classes. The idea is that when faced with a new situation, we can assign it to one of these classes and then generalize based on what we've learned before.
But the researchers in this study claim that this framework is too rigid to explain the full range of human generalization. They identified three key features that are missing: dependency, compositionality, and tuning.
To test these ideas, the researchers developed a clever new behavioral task involving a fishing contest around an island. Participants had to learn where different underwater animals were hiding at various fishing sites and then try to catch them by positioning a cage.
Ah, that sounds like a fun and engaging task. So what did they find?
Well, the first experiment looked at the notion of independence between latent classes. The researchers set up the fishing sites so that some were fully correlated, meaning the hiding spots were the same across sites. But others were anti-correlated, with the hiding spots mirrored across sites.
Interesting. So how did the participants perform on those anti-correlated sites?
Surprisingly, the participants were still able to generalize their knowledge to the anti-correlated sites, even though that's not predicted by the traditional latent class framework. Their performance was significantly better than chance, though not quite as good as on the fully correlated sites.
Ah, so they were able to extract the relationship between the classes and use that to their advantage. That really challenges the independence assumption of the latent class model.
Exactly. The researchers argue that humans can learn about the dependencies between latent classes, which allows for much more flexible generalization than the all-or-nothing approach of the traditional framework.
Okay, that's a great first finding. What about the other two features they looked at? Compositionality and tuning.
In the second experiment, the researchers built on the idea of compositionality. They introduced fishing sites where only some of the hiding spots were correlated or anti-correlated, while others were independent.
So participants had to selectively transfer and adapt different parts of what they'd learned, rather than just applying an entire class of knowledge.
Precisely, and the results showed that participants were indeed sensitive to this compositional structure, performing better on the sites that shared some underlying similarities, even when others were inverted.
Fascinating. That adds another layer of flexibility to human generalization beyond just simple transfer.
Absolutely. And in the third experiment, the researchers really pushed the limits by testing whether participants could dynamically tune their learned behaviors.
Tuning, you say? What do you mean by that?
Well, they introduced fishing sites that required participants to either expand or shrink the range of hiding spots compared to what they had learned before. So it wasn't just about transferring knowledge, but adapting it to fit the new context.
That's a really interesting test. How did the participants handle that?
The results were quite impressive. Even in this very complex environment, participants were able to appropriately tune their behavior, expanding or shrinking the space of their cage drops to match the new hiding spot locations. They didn't just blindly try to transfer their learned knowledge.
Wow, that really demonstrates the remarkable flexibility of human generalization. Being able to not just transfer knowledge, but actively transform it to fit novel situations, that goes way beyond the rigid latent class framework.
Exactly. The researchers argue that current models of learning and generalization need to be significantly extended to capture the full breadth of human capabilities. Things like dependency between classes, compositional representations, and dynamic tuning are all critical features that are missing from traditional approaches.
This is such a fascinating line of research. It really gets at the core of how we as humans are able to so flexibly adapt to new challenges by building on and transforming our prior knowledge.
Absolutely. The findings from this study have important implications for how we think about human intelligence and cognitive flexibility. It pushes us to rethink our theoretical models and develop new frameworks that can truly capture the nuance and sophistication of human learning and generalization.
Well said, Jen. This is the kind of cutting-edge cognitive science research that really expands our understanding of the incredible capabilities of the human mind. I'm sure our listeners are just as captivated by these findings as we are.
I couldn't agree more, Tom. This work opens up so many new avenues for exploration, both in terms of the underlying computational and neural mechanisms, as well as the real-world applications of these insights. It's an exciting time in the field of human cognition.
Well, everyone, there you have it. A deep dive into beyond independent latent classes, testing the limits of human flexibility. This is the kind of research that really pushes the boundaries of what we know about how humans learn and adapt. We'll be sure to keep you updated as this fascinating line of work continues to unfold.
Absolutely. Thanks for joining us on another episode of the Curiosity Collective. We can't wait to explore more incredible discoveries with you in the future. Until next time, keep exploring, Tom and Jen. Goodbye.
Hey there, listeners. We've got a fun commercial to share with you all today.
That's right, Tom. This one's for a brand new company that's taking the world of human flexibility to the next level.
Introducing Flex Factory. The one-stop shop for all your customizable, adaptable, and totally tunable human needs.
Are you tired of being stuck in the same old rigid thought patterns? Well, Flex Factory is here to liberate your mind.
Our state-of-the-art workshops use the latest findings in cognitive science to break down those limiting latent classes and unleash your inner compositional genius.
That's right, with Flex Factory, you can learn to seamlessly transition between specialized knowledge domains. Expand your skills, shrink your weaknesses, the choice is yours.
Need to quickly adapt to a new work environment? Flex Factory's patented neural tuning technology will have you optimized and ready to go in no time.
And the best part? Everything is 100% organic and free range. No artificial constraints or prefabricated classes allowed.
So what are you waiting for? Head on over to flexfactory.com and start exploring the limitless possibilities of your own mind.
Flex Factory. Reprogram your brain, rewire your world. Tom and Jen, flex on, folks. Jingle plays.
Welcome to the Science of Discovery, where we dive deep into the latest cutting-edge research and bring it to life through captivating storytelling. I'm Tom, and joining me today is my co-host Jen.
Hi everyone, we're thrilled to be exploring a fascinating paper that examines the potential for revolutionary media to be created online. The title of the paper is Can Revolutionary Media Be Made Online? And it was written by Noha Atef, an independent researcher from Egypt.
This paper is a case study of Mosserine, a non-profit media collective and alternative media outlet founded by a group of activists, writers, journalists, and filmmakers in the midst of political change in Egypt. Mosserine developed a unique interpretation of revolutionary media and has been executing their ideas on the ground for over 2 years.
The paper looks at how Mosserine leveraged the internet and digital, social media to support political activism and revolutionize media practices during a time of struggle against the regime. It's a really compelling story of how a group of determined individuals came together to create an alternative media model.
That's right, Jen. The researchers used a combination of participant observation and in-depth interviews to understand Mosserine's foundation, administrative and financial policies, major projects, and overall vision for revolutionary media. Let's dive into the details.
Okay, let's start at the beginning. How did Mosserine come to be?
Well, the idea for Mosserine took nearly a year to develop, but it really started with a conversation in Tahrir Square in Cairo in January 2011, during the protests to topple then-President Hosni Mubarak. A group of four people, including future Mosserine member Omar Hamilton, began discussing the videos and images being captured by protesters.
They recognized that mainstream media was using this citizen-generated content to cover the uprising, which sparked the idea of creating a centralized archive for all the protest footage. They set up a collection point in Tahrir Square to gather videos and images from demonstrators.
Exactly. And then a pivotal event crystallized the need for an independent media outlet. In February 2011, military police used force to clear a sit-in at Tahrir Square that was calling for a civil alternative to military rule. The Mosserine co-founders experienced this brutal crackdown firsthand, but when they tried to share their accounts, no one believed them.
That must have been so frustrating. Without any evidence, the military's version of events was accepted as the truth. But then, a few days later, the military actually apologized for the violence, which the Mosserine group saw as a turning point.
Absolutely. They realized that if there had been no video evidence, the victims of the crackdown would have had no recourse. This galvanized the group to form an independent media outlet that would side with victims and document stories that wouldn't be heard in the mainstream media.
And that's when they chose the name Mosserine, which means "we are determined" in Arabic. They secured office space donated by one of the members and started to shape their brand online, creating a logo, YouTube channel, website, and defining the goals and management policies.
The Mosserine team was really committed to sustaining their citizen media institution. As one of the co-founders, Philip Rizke, told the researchers, "We should never stop our activities, and we may spend our lifetimes without achieving all our goals."
That level of dedication is really admirable. And it's clear they had a very specific vision for what they wanted to accomplish with Mosserine. The paper explains how the co-founders rejected the term citizen journalism, preferring to see themselves as activists rather than journalists.
Right, they felt that journalism meant having to be objective and tell both sides of a story, which went against Mosserine's mission of amplifying the voices of the people and the victims. As Lobna Darwish said, "If I am a journalist, I should be objective and tell the two sides of the story, but here I am not." We co-founded Mosserine to give a voice to the people, not to all parties.
That's a really important distinction. Mosserine saw themselves as creating revolutionary media rather than just citizen journalism. The paper outlines several key characteristics of this revolutionary media model, including being participatory, collaborative, financially autonomous, and focused on archiving and documentation to counter dominant narratives.
Exactly. The Tahrir Cinema Project is a great example of Mosserine's participatory approach. They would screen raw footage from the 2011 protests in Tahrir Square, and the audience could actually request specific videos to watch and provide live commentary. It was a true back and forth between the content creators and the viewers.
And financially, Mosserine relied heavily on crowdfunding, hosting fundraising events, and charging for the use of their equipment, all to maintain their independence from traditional media funding sources. This allowed them to pursue their mission without compromise.
Absolutely. And the archiving and documentation aspect was crucial too. Mosserine established what they called the 858 Archive, which grew to over 858 hours of footage from protests between 2009 and 2013. This created an invaluable historical record that could be used to counter the dominant narratives.
It's remarkable how Mosserine was able to leverage the internet and digital, social media to realize this vision of revolutionary media. The paper highlights how social media platforms enabled Mosserine to facilitate communication, networking, fundraising, and the dissemination of their content.
That's a great point. The internet and social media were central to Mosserine's model, but the co-founders were also quite cautious about over-relying on them. They recognized the digital divide in Egypt and tried to find ways to bridge that gap, like experimenting with Bluetooth streaming for their Tahrir cinema screenings.
Right. And they still made efforts to get their content on traditional TV channels, even though they weren't always happy with the editorial control that came with it. It's clear Mosserine was trying to find the right balance between new and old media in order to reach the widest possible audience.
Absolutely. The paper does a great job of tracing Mosserine's evolution, from those initial conversations in Tahrir Square to the eventual launch of their revolutionary media model. And it's really fascinating to see how their use of the internet and digital tools both enabled and shaped their approach.
I agree, Tom. This paper provides such valuable insight into how a group of determined activists can harness online platforms to create an alternative media ecosystem that challenges the status quo. Mossareen's story is both inspiring and thought-provoking.
Definitely. Even though Mossareen ultimately had to shut down their physical office due to the changing political realities in Egypt, their legacy lives on through the 858 archive and the broader impact they had. This research highlights the incredible potential for revolutionary media to be made online, even in the face of adversity.
Absolutely. It's a powerful example of how grassroots movements can leverage digital tools to amplify marginalized voices, document important events, and work towards social change. The Mossareen story is a testament to the power of collective action and the enduring spirit of revolutionary media.
Well said, Jen. This has been a fascinating deep dive into the world of Mossareen and their innovative approach to revolutionary media. I'm sure our listeners have gained a deeper appreciation for the challenges and possibilities of creating transformative media in the digital age.
Definitely. It's been a pleasure exploring this research with you, Tom. Mossareen's story is a remarkable one, and I'm grateful we could share it with our audience today. Revolutionary media may indeed be possible online. This paper is a compelling case study that shows us the way.
Absolutely. Thanks everyone for tuning in. We'll be back next time with more cutting-edge research that's reshaping our understanding of the world. Until then, keep exploring.
See you next time.
Jingle plays. Are you a revolutionary looking to capture the truth and fight the power?
Then you need Mossareen surveillance gear, the ultimate tools for the modern activist.
Feeling like the man is watching your every move? Slip on our state-of-the-art invisible cloaking jacket and disappear from Big Brother's prying eyes.
Documenting injustice? Our micro-drone cameras let you film from anywhere without being detected.
And when you need to transmit your footage securely, use our encrypted livestream backpack to broadcast the revolution in real time.
Mossareen surveillance gear, technology for the resistance. Available now at your local revolutionary supply store or online at mossareenmediakit.com.
Mossareen surveillance gear. Fighting the power, one gadget at a time. Jingle fades out. Welcome to our podcast, where we dive deep into the cutting-edge research that is shaping our understanding of the world. I'm Tom, and joining me today is my co-host, Jen.
Hello, everyone. We're thrilled to be discussing a fascinating paper that investigates the relationships between various lightness illusions and how that information can be used to better evaluate computational models of human perception.
The paper is titled The Relationship of Lightness Illusions Uncovered by Individual Differences and Its Advantage in Model Evaluation, and it was authored by Yuki Kobayashi and Arthur G. Shapiro.
This study is really exciting because it takes a novel approach to understanding lightness perception. Rather than just looking at how individual illusions work, the researchers wanted to explore the underlying connections between these illusions and what that might reveal about the mechanisms driving visual processing.
Exactly. The key idea is that similar illusions may be driven by common underlying processes. By measuring how an individual's perception of one illusion relates to their perception of others, the researchers were able to uncover these shared mechanisms.
And that's not just an interesting academic exercise, it has important implications for how we evaluate the computational models that are trying to explain lightness perception. Let's dive in and see what they discovered.
The researchers started by analyzing a dataset from a previous study that had measured people's perceptions of 11 different lightness illusions. They looked at the correlations between how strongly each individual experienced these illusions.
What they found was really fascinating. The illusions seemed to cluster into a few distinct groups based on these individual differences. Some illusions showed strong positive correlations with each other, suggesting they may be driven by a common assimilation process, while others were more closely linked to a contrast effect.
Interestingly, the researchers also identified a third group of illusions related to the white effect, which seemed to be somewhat distinct from both the assimilation and contrast categories. This suggests that the white effect may involve a unique underlying mechanism.
To dig deeper into these relationships, the researchers then conducted two large-scale online experiments. In the first one, they had over 200 participants view 27 different lightness illusions and adjust the perceived brightness of target areas.
The results from this experiment were really informative. Using factor analysis, the researchers were able to extract three key factors that seemed to underlie the participants' responses. One factor was associated with assimilation effects, another with contrast, and the third specifically with the white effect.
That's so interesting. It really highlights how these seemingly different illusions may actually be tapping into some common perceptual processes. And the fact that the white effect emerged as a distinct factor suggests it's not just a simple contrast or assimilation phenomenon.
Absolutely. The researchers then took this analysis one step further by using the factor structures they had identified to evaluate three computational models of lightness perception, ODOG, LODOG, and FLODOG.
This is where the practical implications of their findings really come into play. By breaking down the model's performance based on the underlying factors, rather than just looking at the total number of illusions they could predict, the researchers were able to get a much more nuanced understanding of the model's strengths and weaknesses.
For example, they found that the FLODOG model seemed to be particularly good at accounting for the assimilation and white effect factors, but not as strong when it came to contrast. Whereas the ODOG and LODOG models were more oriented towards contrast.
That's a really important insight. If you just looked at the overall number of illusions predicted, you might think the FLODOG model was superior. But by considering the factor structure, you realize it has its own biases and limitations.
Exactly. This highlights why simply counting the number of illusions a model can predict is an oversimplification. The relationships between the illusions matter just as much, if not more, in evaluating the underlying mechanisms that these models are trying to capture.
And the researchers didn't stop there. They also looked at the correlations between the model outputs and the actual human perceptions, which revealed that while the models may be good at qualitatively predicting the direction of illusions, the quantitative predictions are still lacking.
That's a really important point. Just because a model can correctly predict whether an illusion will make a target appear lighter or darker doesn't mean it's fully capturing the magnitude of that effect. There's still work to be done to develop models that can truly match human lightness perception.
This study is so thoughtful and multifaceted. It not only advances our understanding of lightness illusions and their underlying mechanisms, but it also provides a roadmap for how to rigorously evaluate the computational models that are trying to explain these perceptual phenomena.
Absolutely. By considering the relationships between illusions, rather than just treating them as independent data points, the researchers have opened up new avenues for refining and improving these models. It's a really impressive and impactful piece of work.
I couldn't agree more. This is the kind of research that not only expands our scientific knowledge, but also has the potential to shape the development of practical applications, like computer vision and augmented reality. It's exciting to see such innovative and insightful work in the field of visual perception.
Definitely. This study really highlights the value of taking a holistic, multifaceted approach to understanding complex perceptual processes. It's not enough to just look at individual illusions or models in isolation. You have to consider the bigger picture and the underlying connections.
Absolutely. And the researchers have provided such a great model for how to do that. By combining large-scale experiments, sophisticated data analysis techniques, and a deep understanding of the theoretical landscape, they've been able to uncover truly novel insights.
It's the kind of work that really pushes the field forward and opens up new avenues for exploration. I can't wait to see what other discoveries come out of this line of research. Lightness perception may seem like a narrow topic, but it's clearly got so much depth and complexity to it.
Definitely. This study is a fantastic example of how rigorous, innovative research can shed light on the intricacies of human visual processing. It's a perfect illustration of why we love delving into these cutting-edge discoveries on our podcast.
Absolutely. This has been a fascinating dive into an incredibly insightful piece of research. I'm sure our listeners are as impressed as we are by the depth of the analysis and the potential impact of these findings.
Absolutely. This is the kind of work that reminds us why we're so passionate about exploring the latest advancements in scientific research. It's not just about the facts and figures, it's about uncovering the underlying mechanisms that shape our experience of the world.
Couldn't agree more. Well, that's all the time we have for today. Thanks everyone for joining us on this journey through the fascinating world of lightness, illusions, and computational models of perception. Be sure to tune in next time for another exciting exploration of cutting-edge research.
Yes, thanks so much for listening. Until next time, keep exploring and stay curious.
Are you tired of struggling with the perplexing mysteries of lightness and contrast? Do you find yourself constantly wondering why the world looks the way it does?
Introducing the Lightness Illusion Illuminator, the ultimate device for hacking your visual perception and unlocking the secrets of the universe.
Using cutting-edge technology inspired by the latest research in computational models of lightness processing, the Lightness Illusion Illuminator will transform the way you see the world.
Simply strap on the sleek, futuristic headset and prepare to have your mind blown. Suddenly, those tricky white effects and assimilation phenomena will become crystal clear.
No more will you be baffled by the conflicting contrast cues that plague your everyday life. The Lightness Illusion Illuminator will give you superhuman powers of visual discernment.
Explore the hidden dimensions of lightness with the touch of a button. Adjust the settings to toggle between different perceptual factors and see the world in a whole new way.
Impress your friends, confound your enemies, and maybe even make a few bucks as a consultant for computer vision companies. The Lightness Illusion Illuminator is your ticket to visual enlightenment.
Order now for the low, low price of 3 easy payments of $19.95. Satisfaction guaranteed or your money back, we're confident it will transform your life.
The Lightness Illusion Illuminator, because seeing is believing, and we're about to change the way you see everything. Get yours today. Welcome to the Cognitive Curiosity Podcast. I'm Tom, here with my co-host Jen.
Today we're diving into a fascinating paper that investigates the benefits of removing information from our working memory. The title of the paper is The Benefit of Removing Information from Working Memory, Increasing Available Cognitive Resources or Reducing Interference.
This is some cutting-edge research that really gets to the heart of how our working memory functions. The authors, Chun-Yu Li, Gideon T. Frischkorn, Hannah Dames, and Klaus Oberauer, set out to understand whether removing irrelevant information from working memory helps us by freeing up cognitive resources or by reducing interference.
It's a really intriguing question. We're constantly having to update the information in our working memory as we go about our daily lives. Removing outdated or irrelevant information is crucial to make room for new, relevant information. But the underlying mechanisms behind why this removal is beneficial have been unclear.
Exactly. There are two main perspectives the authors explore. One is the interference theory, which says that representations in working memory interfere with each other, and removing irrelevant information reduces that interference, leading to better performance.
The other view is the resource theory, which suggests that maintaining information in working memory requires allocating limited cognitive resources to those representations. Removing some information frees up those resources, which can then be reallocated to other items to boost their memory.
The interesting thing is, previous studies have found a removal benefit, but only when the irrelevant information was removed immediately after being encoded, not when it was removed with a delay. This discrepancy is what the current paper set out to investigate.
To do that, the researchers conducted two experiments. In experiment 1, they had participants complete a working memory task with various conditions, some where items were removed immediately, some where they were removed after a delay, and baseline conditions with no removal.
The results from experiment 1 were quite intriguing. They found that both immediate and delayed removal improved memory for the items that were still maintained in working memory, compared to the baseline conditions.
However, the benefit was larger for the conditions with more immediate removal. The authors suggest this could be because immediate removal is more effective at actually removing the irrelevant information from working memory, whereas delayed removal leaves more of that information lingering.
But interestingly, the memory measurement model they used showed that the TBF, or to be forgotten, items were barely removed from working memory in any of the conditions. The items' identities were still interfering, even after removal was attempted.
That's a puzzling finding. If the irrelevant items weren't successfully removed, how did the removal still benefit memory for the other items? This is where the author's exploration of the resource theory versus interference theory comes into play.
The key seems to be that while the item identities weren't fully removed, the binding between those items and their spatial contexts was weakened. The removal process appeared to free up resources for binding the remaining items to their locations, which is a critical aspect of working memory.
I see. So the removal didn't necessarily reduce interference, but it did increase the cognitive resources available for forming strong bindings between the relevant items and their contexts. That would explain why subsequently encoded items benefited, even if previously encoded items did not.
Exactly. To further test this idea, the researchers conducted experiment 2, where they separated the encoding of items into two stages, some before removal, and some after.
And that's where the findings really started to crystallize. They found that removal only benefited the items encoded after the removal occurred, not the ones encoded beforehand. This suggests that removal frees up resources specifically for binding new information, rather than reducing interference more broadly.
It's a fascinating result. The authors conclude that removal of information from working memory unbinds those items from their contexts, freeing up resources that can then be used to better bind subsequently encoded items to their spatial locations. But it doesn't seem to reduce the interfering effect of the item identities themselves.
So in summary, this research provides evidence that the benefit of removing irrelevant information from working memory comes not from reducing interference, but from increasing the cognitive resources available for binding new information. It's a really nuanced finding that sheds important light on the mechanisms underlying working memory maintenance.
Absolutely. I find it particularly interesting how this challenges some of the prevailing interference-based theories of working memory. The authors make a compelling case that resource allocation is a key factor in understanding the benefits of removal.
Agreed. This is the kind of research that really pushes our understanding of the complex inner workings of the mind forward. By carefully isolating the mechanisms at play, the researchers have uncovered an important new insight into how we manage the limited capacity of our working memory.
It makes me wonder about the real-world implications. If removal primarily frees up resources for binding new information, that could have interesting applications in education, training, or even cognitive therapy. Being able to strategically remove irrelevant mental clutter to make room for new learning seems incredibly valuable.
Definitely. And of course, this also raises new questions for future research. How generalizable are these findings? Are there individual differences in people's ability to effectively remove information? What other factors might influence the benefits of removal? There's still much to be explored.
Absolutely. This is the kind of foundational work that opens up all sorts of exciting new avenues for investigation. I'm really impressed by the depth of analysis and the care the authors took in teasing apart these complex cognitive processes.
Me too. It's a great example of how rigorous, theory-driven research can shed light on the mysteries of the human mind. I think listeners will find this a fascinating exploration of the nuanced interplay between memory, attention, and cognitive control.
Definitely. Well, there you have it. A deep dive into the benefit of removing information from working memory. This research challenges some long-held assumptions and points the way toward a more refined understanding of how we manage the contents of our working memory. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Be sure to tune in next time as we investigate another cutting-edge discovery in the world of cognitive science. Until then, keep exploring the fascinating inner workings of the mind.
Are you tired of your working memory feeling like a crowded closet? Introducing
Cognitive Uncluttering, the revolutionary new app that helps you digitally remove irrelevant information from your mind.
That's right. Cognitive Uncluttering uses the latest neuroscience to identify the mental junk taking up precious space in your working memory.
With just a tap, Our patented unbinding technology gently releases those pesky memories from their spatial contexts, freeing up critical resources to help you remember what really matters.
No more interference, no more overwhelm. Just a clean, optimized mental workspace ready to take on any task.
Cognitive uncluttering, because who needs a photographic memory when you can have a minimalist one?
Download Cognitive Uncluttering now and start decluttering your mind. Available on iOS, Android, and Direct Neural Interface.
Cognitive Uncluttering, better living through selective forgetting.
Welcome to the Cutting Edge Discoveries podcast. I'm Tom, and joining me is my co-host, Jen.
Hi everyone. Today, we're excited to dive into a fascinating research paper that explores the perceived risk and utility of different medical technologies. The title of the paper is Perceived Risk-Utility Trade-offs of Medical Technology, a Visual Mapping, and it was authored by Philip Brauner and Julia Offerman.
This study takes a unique approach by looking at a broad range of medical technologies, rather than just focusing on individual ones. The researchers wanted to understand how people perceive the risks and benefits of various medical tools and treatments, and how those perceptions influence their overall acceptance of these technologies.
The researchers conducted a comprehensive online survey with 193 participants, asking them to evaluate 20 different medical technologies on measures of perceived risk, perceived utility, and overall valence or attitude. This allowed the researchers to directly compare how people view a diverse set of medical innovations.
One of the key findings was that, on average, the participants saw the set of medical technologies as rather safe and useful, with a positive overall attitude towards them. The technologies perceived as least risky were things like the analog blood pressure monitor, the home emergency call button, and the plaster cast.
In contrast, the technologies seen as having the highest perceived risk were the X-ray, robotic surgery, and mRNA vaccines. Interestingly, only the mRNA vaccines were actually viewed as slightly risky, while the others were still seen as relatively safe.
When it came to perceived utility, the top-rated technologies were the analog blood pressure monitor, the home emergency button, and magnetic resonance imaging. On the lower end, preventive healthcare apps, nursing robots, and mRNA vaccines were seen as less useful, though still viewed positively overall.
The researchers then took this data and created a visual risk utility map to plot out the different medical technologies. They found that most of the technologies clustered in the upper left quadrant, with higher utility and lower risk. The only real outlier was the mRNA vaccines, which fell into the higher risk and higher utility quadrant.
Digging deeper into the relationships between the different factors, the researchers found a strong negative correlation between perceived risk and perceived utility. In other words, the technology seen as more risky tended to also be viewed as less useful.
Interestingly, the overall valence or attitude towards the technologies was much more strongly predicted by perceived utility than by perceived risk. The researchers' multiple regression model showed that utility accounted for the vast majority of the variance in overall valence, with risk playing a much smaller role.
This suggests that when people are evaluating medical technologies, they tend to weigh the potential benefits much more heavily than the potential risks. The researchers concluded that in communicating about these technologies, focusing on emphasizing the benefits may be a more effective strategy than just trying to mitigate the perceived risks.
The study also looked at how individual differences among the participants influenced their evaluations. They found that factors like care experience, both personal and professional, as well as trust in physicians, were significantly related to perceptions of utility and overall valence.
Demographic factors like age, gender, and education level, on the other hand, did not seem to play a major role. This highlights the importance of considering the diverse perspectives and lived experiences of end users when it comes to the adoption and acceptance of new medical technologies.
Overall, this research provides a fascinating and comprehensive look at how people perceive the risk-utility trade-offs of a wide range of medical innovations. By taking a big-picture approach and using creative visual mapping techniques, the researchers were able to uncover some really compelling insights.
I found it particularly intriguing how the perceived benefits seem to be the dominant factor driving people's overall attitudes. It really speaks to the importance of effective communication and framing when it comes to rolling out new medical technologies.
Absolutely. And the findings around individual differences, like the role of care experience and trust in physicians, are a great reminder that we need to consider the diverse needs and perspectives of end users. A one-size-fits-all approach just isn't going to cut it.
Definitely. This study sets the stage for a lot of really interesting follow-up work. I'd love to see the researchers dig deeper into the reasons behind these perceptions, and maybe even explore how they might vary across different healthcare contexts and cultures.
Me too. There's so much rich potential here for understanding the human factors that influence the adoption and use of medical technologies. This is the kind of foundational research that can really help us build more effective, equitable, and user-centered health systems.
Absolutely. Well, listeners, I hope you found this exploration of perceived risk-utility trade-offs of medical technology as fascinating as we did. It's a great example of how rigorous, thoughtful research can shed new light on important real-world challenges.
Yes, and we're grateful to the authors, Philip Brauner and Julia Offerman, for conducting this insightful study. Their work is a valuable contribution to the field, and we look forward to seeing what other cutting-edge discoveries they uncover in the future.
Until next time, this is Tom
and Jen, signing off. Thanks for listening.
And now, a word from our sponsor.
Are you tired of the anxiety and uncertainty around new medical technologies? Introducing RiskTech, the revolutionary device that measures your personal risk tolerance.
RiskTech uses advanced biometric sensors to analyze your brainwaves, heart rate, and sweat levels, then calculates your precise risk threshold. Never again wonder if that fancy new surgery robot or vaccine is right for you.
Simply strap on your RiskTech wearable, and it will guide you through a customized risk-benefit analysis for any medical technology. Worried about that MRI machine? RiskTech will tell you if the rewards outweigh the risks.
RiskTech, because your health is worth the gamble. Available now at your local cybernetics outlet. Side effects may include overconfidence, selective hearing, and a strong urge to start your own podcast.
RiskTech, the future of healthcare is in your hands. Or is it? You'll have to strap on a RiskTech to find out.